Good morning.
Good morning.
Wow, I think Mr. Young trained you guys well. If you are, as Jack said, if you're visiting with us this morning, we're thankful that you're here. This month we are going through a lesson series called A Connected Life. This series will kick us off for the rest of our year, the theme that we're doing for the rest of this year. And so we are glad you're here. We're also going through a thing at the same time called the Faith at Home Month. Faith at Home Month is where we take a month out of our year to really try to figure out what can we do to make sure that this sanctuary is not the the primary place for spiritual growth. We hope that would be in your living rooms and on your kitchen tables and as you're going about your day. Talking about guests, I am thankful to have one of my good friends here, Stephen Bryce, and his wife. He's a good preacher in his own right. I'm not sure if I should be acknowledging him or not. He was at my house this Friday, and he told me that he was coming here to hear me preach. And I said, "And I really appreciate that you're coming to support me." He said, "I'm not coming to support you. I'm coming because you guys start at 9 o'clock." And also, I know you never preach more than 15 minutes, so I know I can get out the door. So I'm glad he's here. In 1992, a man by the name of Gary Chapman wrote a book called The Five Love Languages. What Dr. Chapman noticed was that a lot of marriages were falling apart, not because of a lack of effort, but because the people were expressing their loves in ways that couldn't be understood by their mate. In the book, Dr. Chapman explains that expressing love and affection is like speaking a language, and the sender must be aware of the language of the receiver. This past week, I took a January course. And throughout the course, every student had to lead a devotional during the duration of the week. And one of my classmates that was in the class was actually one of the supported missionaries of Hillcrest named Pam Sullivan. And during her devotion, she talked about a student that she was studying the Bible with, who's a new convert, and she was trying to help her understand some different Christian concepts. And the girl asked her, "How do you love God?" This question is not very different from a lot of questions we often ask. How do we know what's pleasing to God? What does God expect out of me? How do I know if I'm doing what God has called me to do? All these questions stem from the same motivation. If our God is as loving as we say he is, how do we respond to him appropriately? In our text this morning, Israel is probably having some very similar questions. Because just like the new Christian, Israel's relationship with God was still relatively new. Their Mosaic covenant with him was only about 40 years old. The God who had rescued them from Egypt, they wanted to know how to respond to him. How do we love him? In Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 5, Moses lays out God's love language. In verse 4, he begins with the Lord is God and God alone. Monotheism is not a concept for it was a new concept for Israel, mainly because their neighboring nations were all polytheistic nations, not to mention all the years they had spent in Egypt with Pharaoh. Just like some of the people in Chapman's book, there were some growing pains in learning how to love one another. In Exodus, when Israel thought that Moses was not coming back, they decided to take all their gold, mold it together, and make a golden calf. God, furious, ready to destroy them, only stopped himself because Moses talked him out of it. Or maybe in Numbers, when a couple of men seduced by Moabite women ate from the plate of Baal. By the time we get to Deuteronomy, the Israelites start to get the picture that they were created to love God and wasn't planning on sharing him with anyone. This is why this passage is so important to the Old Testament Jews. They quoted in the morning, at night, and during private prayer and during services. The Shema was their life was centered on. The relationship between God and his people was not a contract. It was not agreement. It was a union, a covenant, a marriage, a love affair. In verse 5, Moses tells us how we are to love God. Jesus would later refer to this passage as the greatest command. God's expecting from us the one thing he can't give to himself, our love and devotion. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord with all your heart. For the Hebrew, the heart represents the man's will, his longings, his desires. Christianity is not just behavior management, it's the transformation of the will. To follow Jesus without aligning our desires with God is not discipleship. It's asceticism, divine torture, and it would not lead to obedience, but it will lead to moral failure. A preacher once said that some people just have just enough Christianity to make them miserable. And I agree with him. To obey God without a desire to robs our faith of all its joy, happiness, and pleasure. John Piper, the author of God is Gospel, wrote these words. The critical question for our generation and for every generation is this. If you could have heaven with no sickness and with all the friends you've ever had on earth and all the food you ever liked and all the leisure activities you've ever enjoyed and all the natural beauties you ever saw, all the physical pleasures you've ever tasted, and no human conflict or any natural disasters, could you be satisfied in heaven if Christ were not there? That quote makes me think, do I desire God or do I desire the things that He gives me? I've heard many people say that God is not in the business of making us happy. And I'm starting to realize that's not true. God is in the business of immense happiness. The question is, do we want what He's offering? The Beatitudes show us exactly how to find happiness in God. But if you're not wanting the things He's given, it really doesn't work the way it's supposed to. In Matthew chapter 4, we find the one person who speaks God's love language fluently, Jesus. Starting in verse 1, he says, "Then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. After fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. The tempter came to him and said, 'If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread.' Jesus answered, 'It is written, man will not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God.'" I find it interesting that Satan tempts Jesus with bread as if this was sin for Jesus to be hungry. But Jesus knew that he had a desire that had to be more important than food, or that any other thing for survival or necessity. Which makes me wonder, how many good things do Satan tempt us with? Do I desire knowledge more than God? Do I desire comfort more than God? Do I desire safety more than God? Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. The word soul can be translated to mean the time rendered between birth and death. In the Old Testament, concepts of the afterlife was almost non-existent. Back in Matthew chapter 4, verse 5, Satan tempts Jesus again. Then the devil took him to the holy city and had him stand on the highest point of the temple. "If you are the Son of God," he said, "throw yourself down. For it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and they will lift up in their hands, so that they will not strike your foot against the stone." Jesus answered him, "It is also written, do not put the Lord your God to the test." God is expecting the way we spend our time and the way we live our lives to be expressions of our love for him. The more I study this passage, I'm starting to realize that the way Jesus responds has little to do with Satan's intentions. Satan didn't answer the power to take Jesus' life himself. If he could, he would have, because Jesus posed a threat to him. So instead of trying to kill Jesus, he tries to get Jesus to kill himself. It doesn't matter whether Jesus believed that God could save him or not. Instead, it portrays Jesus' intention to love God with all his life, even if it could cost him his life. As a matter of fact, Jesus came to earth knowing that he had to die in order to be raised back to heaven. There are three things we can learn from Jesus' response in Matthew chapter 4. The first thing is this: my life is not my own. Romans 12:1 says that real worship is not done in the church building, but instead daily dying to myself so that Jesus can be glorified in me. Satan tempts us with the same thing he tempted Jesus with: self-preservation. We choose the neighborhood we live in because it's safe. We choose the school our kids go to because it's safe. We choose what church we go to because it's the place we feel the most comfortable. Where is the real worship in our life? Number two, that time is a depleting resource. Jesus had 3 years to change the course of human history. He didn't have time to be playing around with Satan in the wilderness. He had no time for distractions. He had to be focused on his mission. So many times in the gospel, he tells people, I was sent. I'm sent. I'm here for a reason. I'm here with a purpose. Ephesians 5 says, be very careful then how you live, not as unwise, but as wise, making the most of every opportunity because the days are evil. The class I took this past week was called Ministry in Times of Crisis. And every single day I left that class, it was real. It was very real that death is coming to us all. That we have a certain amount of time on earth to do the will of God. And that time won't be given to us. Time, unlike material things, cannot be saved, stored up, or put aside for a rainy day. Nor can it be taken or given or sold or borrowed. To talk about serving God in the future is like buying things with money you don't have. Time cannot be given to someone else. The time God has given you is the time He has given you. As the psalmist said, we have to count our days. We have to make our days count because we don't get a second chance to do what He has called us to do. And thirdly, it is only by giving up our life that we're able to receive it. The irony of Christianity is not that life is found in, the irony of Christianity is that life is found in death. Death of our plans, death of our own will, and death of our own desires for the sake of the kingdom. Galatians 2:20 says, I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I now live in the body, I live by the faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. Loving God with all my soul reminds me of the illustration with Francis Chan, where he's holding on to a balance beam, and he's representing how some of us live our life. That we're sitting there and we're making everything comfortable for ourselves, making everything safe for ourselves. And even though hugging on to the balance beam will make our lives less risky and more comfortable, it makes for a very boring performance. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. The strength referred to in verse 5 does not refer to the muscles under our skin, but the staff in our hand. In Exodus 4, God shows Moses the power and the strength he possessed by just holding up a measly staff. See what you have. See what's in your hand. Look at what I've given you to change the world with. When I was younger, my dad owned a little small construction company that he always wanted me to take over when his days were over. And so he would take me out there every summer and make me work in the hot Memphis heat. And one of the things he would do was show me how to operate we had a yellow case backhoe. And as he was training me how to work this thing, he would take me out on jobs and let me operate it just like he would. And whatever job we were doing, usually you had about 3 or 4 men that were surrounded by the job site, and they were helping with their shovels and picks and everything else. And I always noticed that whenever I was operating the machine, they always kind of stood a little farther away from the hole. I was a little guy, but I think they understood that there was a lot of strength in me holding those levers. Our strength is whatever God has given us in order for Him to be glorified. But with our position and our possessions, we have to make the choice of making a lot of ourselves or making a lot out of God. In Matthew 4, Satan runs out of options. So for his last temptation, he holds no punches. He comes out and he says exactly what he is wanting. Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. All this I give you, he said, if you will bow down and worship me. Jesus said to him, away from me, Satan. It is written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only. Then the devil left him and angels came and attended to him. Jesus is teaching us not to only love God by how we use our things we have, use the things we have, but how we love them, by how we attain them. Our wealth can't come at the expense of our families, our spiritual health, and most importantly, our own morality. Matthew 16:24 says, "What good will it do for a man to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his own soul? Or what can it give in exchange for their soul?" God is orchestrating our devotion to him to make sure that he is our number one priority. God wants us to have him at the forefront of our lives. What does that mean for our families when God is the most important thing in our lives? What does that mean for our spirituality when God is the most first thing in our lives? As I offer the invitation right now, God is not wanting anything from you. He has all the time. He has all things. But he's wanting the one thing from you that he can't get from himself, and that's your love, your devotion. This is the most vulnerable thing in God, is that he can't control it. He can't control your will. He can't control your choice. And he can't control you giving your heart to him. So as Otis comes up and sings us our song of invitation, the invitation is open to you. The invitation is not from me. It's God's invitation to us. So you don't have to feel like this is not for you. Maybe you've been a member here for 20, 30 years. The invitation is open to you as well. All the time we're trying to figure out how to love God more, how to make our devotion to him more and more deep. How do we center our lives around the Shema? How do we make it the most important thing in our life?